We have an idea of something called bioprospecting. So you could almost imagine an explorer with his wide-brimmed hat out in the jungle on the floor, you know, looking for different varieties of beautiful flowers, taking saplings, taking seeds, and heading back home, cultivate them and see if they could survive in a European climate, okay? That was happening in the colonial times. So there were definitely explorers who were going, who were bringing back these varieties of flowers. We talk about Dutch flower growing or French flower growing. Well, okay, yes, it is being done on French soil, okay? But a lot of these plants, the genetic material many hundreds of years ago had been taken from another country.
Many of us decorate our homes with plants and flowers sourced from all across the world. Behind this global trade lies a long history of biodiversity extraction that dates back to the colonial era and helped Europe cultivate a multi-billion euro flower industry. But the countries and communities from which its resources were taken have been left with very little, if anything, in return. This is the podcast of the European investigative newsroom Follow the Money. I'm your host, Emma, and today I'm joined by investigative journalist Dylan Carter. Good morning, Dylan. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Good morning.
Well, to jump straight in, your story is about the commercial flower market. How did you first get the idea of investigating this topic? Are you a big fan of flowers yourself?
No, I have to say I'm a particularly poor gardener. I've never had much of an acumen for growing flowers. It started quite a boring way. I was looking for new stories, as you do. I tried to write for the media across Europe, and I saw a call for pitches from, I think it was a National Geographic. And they gave a long list of different topics they were looking for hard-hitting journalism on. And one of the ones that they said was garden flowers. And I started thinking to myself, and you know, what would hard-hitting journalism look like about garden flowers? I was sat looking into my neighbor's garden, as beautiful as it is compared to my very shoddy terrace on my apartment, and I started to think, well, where do these flowers actually come from? And I'm not talking about where they were grown, but where were they from originally? Okay, where did their genetic material come? Let's say 1,000 years ago, if I wanted to pick up a daffodil, where was I finding that plant? Or roses? Or, you know, any real kind of garden flower or even indoor flower that we have and you can buy commercially. And that sent me down a huge rabbit hole.
So your average household here in Europe, would you say that most of the plants that people have in and around their houses are actually not from Europe?
Yeah, almost certainly. I mean, the plant genetic material for commercial varieties of household plants, I think the statistics I read, it's around between 40 and 60% of commercialized varieties in the ornamental sector, ornamentals being flowers that are there to look good. They don't have a specific purpose, are with genetic material that comes from what we call the global south.
And to do this investigation, you analyzed tens of thousands of patents and breeding rights for plants. How exactly did you go about this investigation?
So I'm more of a data journalist. So I started it, of course, with the most nerdy technical data approach. There is essentially a database of all the, what they call plant breeders' rights. Plant breeders' rights. So essentially, if you have made some variety of plant crossing genetics, okay, you can basically apply to this certification body and say, look, this is my commercial variety. I'm going to use it. Okay, you cannot market my specific formula of plant. And these licenses say that they cannot be commercialized by other people. Essentially, there's this database, which is the EU's Plant Varieties Rights Registry, the CPVO. And it started really simply by me just basically scraping that data and sifting through and seeing, okay, well, who owns what? What kind of flower varieties are highly protected? In which fields are there competition? To understand, you know, who are the commercial, you know, the big players behind the commercial flower market. And that opened the door to a whole other bunch of questions. It was meant to be a simple story. And it ended up taking many months of research, speaking to experts, the topic that I knew nothing about. It was very rewarding. But yeah, it's a topic.
Yeah, just to have that very clear, what we're talking about here and what you really researched is not actually plants or flowers themselves, but the genetic material behind those plants, right?
Yeah. So we have an idea of something called bioprospecting. So you could almost imagine an explorer with his wide-brimmed hat out in the jungle on the floor, you know, looking for different varieties of beautiful flowers, taking saplings, taking seeds, and heading back home, cultivate them and see if they could survive in a European climate, okay? That was happening in the colonial times. So there were definitely explorers who were bringing back these varieties of flowers. To be very clear, that's not really happening that much anymore. The law is very strict on people doing that, on going to other countries and picking up genetic material in situ. But the fact is that we talk about Dutch flower growing or French flower growing. Well, okay, yes, it is being done on French soil. Okay, but a lot of these plants, the genetic material, many hundreds of years ago have been taken from another country. They've been bred, interbred. They're on, you know, hundreds of generations of genetic material, so much so that it's often very, very difficult to point a finger and say, well, where was the original genetic material from? We've lost that chain of accountability. It's very, very hard. Countries are trying to do this, trying to trace origin, and they're not having the easiest time with it. The root element of it is that this genetic material is not native to Europe. It came from somewhere else. And there were people pushing for this argument that there should be some form of recompense to the communities where that genetic material originally came from.
Just to get an idea, so European companies are hugely profiting from that genetic material that was taken centuries ago. What kind of market are we speaking about here? How large is it?
It's a very, very large market. So if we're looking at statistics, the European flower market is worth around 17 billion euros. Okay. Royal Flora Holland, which is like one of the biggest consortiums of flower growers in the world, in 2025, I think it had a turnover of about 5.4 billion euros. Okay.
So Europe massively profits from this flower industry. But then what you found in your article is that the communities where the genetic material comes from and that have made this market so profitable often get nothing in return.
Yeah, so we have, I think the best example I can think of would be the poinsettia. I might be saying that wrong, poinsettias. Anyway, this is a variety of plant, quite pretty. You'll find it in most gardens. And this is a plant very specifically unique to Mexico or even to certain communities, Mayan people in Mexico. And 99% of the portfolio of what is sold in Europe for this type of flower is held by one company, okay? So, or a one or two maybe max. And the Mexicans, the people who, you know, have a cultural attachment to this flower, who use it as a symbol, have absolutely nothing to do with it, really. They don't own the rights to commercialize those flowers. So there's this detachment from cultural identity, cultural traditions and history, and to the commercial market, but there are specific communities and efforts that has been put into that. And then that knowledge, which has been passed down for generations and generations, maybe specific how to use that plant or how to grow it, how to plant it, is all of a sudden transported thousands of miles away, and you see your own products commercialized. And the argument that the UN has been making and other experts have been making that I try to argue for is that there should be some mechanism whereby if some intangible part of your culture is being used, genetic material specifically, that some of the profits should be returned.
Yeah. So it's like, okay, thank you for centuries of this knowledge of enhancing this variety. We'll now take it from here, advance it further, and we'll reap all the benefits.
Exactly.
So, but when we speak about rules and regulation that could actually make this system more fair, we do have some rules in place already. You mentioned in your story two sets of rules, the UN Convention on Biological Diversity, and then later the Nagoya Protocol. What were these frameworks supposed to do? Why were they put in place?
Okay, so essentially the UN Convention on Biological Diversity, we just called it CBD, established the fact that countries should have sovereign rights over their own genetic resources and that benefits that come from them should be used fairly. essentially, all it was meant to do was encourage nations to start thinking conscientiously about this prospect of you have your own national genetic material. You can, for some sort of recompense in many, many sectors, for the use of that. That doesn't extend to just plants. It's also for things like medical uses. So if you're taking genetic material used in treatments, it can be for agriculture. There was a much more emphasis on that. But essentially, the early stages didn't really have any bite, any enforcement mechanism. But yes, the idea was that there could be some pushes, or they could refer to this this convention to ask formally for some form of recompense for that genetic material.
But then, aside from this CBD that we've now discussed, there's also the Nagoya Protocol. What was the intention of that protocol?
So the Nagoya was meant to, essentially, to give CBD considerations teeth, okay, an actual enforcement action. Okay, it was the real legal architecture behind, or in front, we could say, of the CBD. It's 141 countries, including the EU, who ratified it. Okay, and it called and created a system which we now call access and benefit sharing. You'll hear this a lot now. It's called ABS, which, if you use genetic material from a country, okay, and you use that to develop a commercial product, that country where you got the material from should get a cut. Now, that was how it was devised. We have systems for this. Countries can initiate proceedings and quote the Nagoya Protocol, reclaim that they should receive some sort of compensation as a result of ABS. Does that mean even still that it's being used that much? Well, as I found in the commercial flower sector, the answer is no. The biggest reason for that being that the Nagoya Protocol specifically says that there was a cutoff. If your genetic material was sourced before 2014, you have no benefits to pay. And that has gutted the utility of this protocol.
Yeah, because as you said, it actually mostly stems from colonial times.
Exactly. So if you have a whole genetic material based on stuff that had been taken during the Victorian era, or had been taken even in the early 2000s or in the 90s, the Nagoya Protocol is not going to help you. 2014 was a cutoff. And as was acknowledged by a lot of the lobby groups who were trying to suppress Nagoya, they made a big sigh of relief across many industries, because they said, well, it doesn't matter. All the genetic material we're using has been with us for hundreds of years. There's barely any commercial flower grower now who is accessing genetic material that has been sourced after 2014.
So that basically means that they also already have everything they need from pre-2014, and they don't really need anything from after that.
No, exactly. And when you have those super long chains as well of different varieties, they're not breeding from, let's say, the source plant. Let's say they're not breeding off an original poinsettia which came from Mexico. No, they're breeding off from super hardy, super genetically engineered variety, which has changed hands, or the genetics have changed hands many, many, many times. At that point, they will say, well, we got this specific variety that came, well, we received in 2020. They're not interested in the fact that the poinsettia itself was during colonial times. That's going back to. And Nagoya says, well, you don't have to think that far. And it guts the utility of it.
So does Nagoya would more work in the hypothetical scenario that if, let's say, in Indonesia, now a new variety of plants in the jungle is discovered that has not been cultivated before, then this Nagoya Protocol would actually apply?
The sectors in which we see it more actively used are things like vaccine development, new medicines, okay? Because in those sectors, in the biomedical sector, they are always looking for new genetic material which is not already out there, that has not been digitized.
You just mentioned lobby groups, and when we speak about the commercial plant sector, where do these lobby groups come from? What are sort of the big interests here?
Okay, so there are two major lobbies. Now, just because I use the word lobby does not mean that they're some evil overlords. No, quite the opposite. They are the groups that represent the commercial flower growing sector. We have two main players. Okay, we have the Siapora, and the International Association of Horticultural Producers. And in January 2021, they scored a big win for the commercial flower sector. Essentially, they got the commission to issue a guidance to them and other growers saying that, listen, if you make a new flower from something that is already on the market, okay? So let's say there's some variety of rose that's already on the market. I make a new variety out of that. It does not trigger benefit sharing. It essentially got the European Commission to be clear that Nagoya's implementation on the flower sector would be very, very limited, because it was up for interpretation as to how much benefit sharing or considerations that these flowers growers should be doing. They were worrying, saying, well, are we going to have to go and trace back the whole genetic history of our flower growing lines? The Commission, essentially, after a lot of pressure from these commercial flower growers, explicitly said that at least for the EU growers, they do not need to enact any benefit sharing if they are breeding from already commercially available varieties, which, if you're a local community back in, I don't know, in the global south, that's a bit of a kick in the teeth, because that Nagoya essentially never had much teeth at all, and the European Commission gave it a death blow. Essentially, it removed any possible interpretation that there might be some sort of benefits.
And I think you've clearly set out here who benefits from this system. That's mainly the European flower giants, so to say. And who would you say ends up carrying the burden of this system?
This is where we go again to the more philosophical. Technically speaking, there is no direct burden. When there's no benefit sharing happening, there's nobody missing out, okay? So to say that there's somebody specifically being hurt right now, no, I can't say that anybody is being hurt. What I can say is it's a shame, because there is the potential to do a lot of good. I was speaking to one of the experts in my stories who is working for the Third World Alliance, who represent some of these communities in negotiations at the UN level on issues relating to benefit sharing and accountability. And he essentially said to me, if around about 20% of the benefit sharing that should happen happened, we could almost completely meet the needs of those vulnerable communities, especially those communities where they are the primary givers of material. And for flower growers, it would not necessarily be a massive payment. And it's not that every flower grower, a small little one-man shop operating somewhere in the Netherlands, is going to be asked to fork over thousands and thousands of euros. But there could be mechanisms whereby a small percentage is diverting to where it's needed.
And then what you're suggesting here is not a mechanism of charity, but more fair compensation for something that should have happened over the past centuries already.
Yeah, I think you can fairly strongly make this argument. The comparisons I would make is that we are now more conscious of, for example, inadequacies. Okay? We're more conscious. We're having greater scrutiny on the British Museum, for example, for taking pieces of archaeology and history and returning them to their original owners. Okay, having some sort of benefit mechanism or some sort of at least intellectual exchange between research institutions, so that's not that structural imbalance, making sure that deals are fair. At the moment, it's a bit of a sore deal. It is, I can see that my nation's flower is across the world. I can go into any plant shop and it's right there in front of me, but I'm living below the poverty line and this was mine, but I haven't seen a penny for it. This is what hurts. And this, for me, I think is the underlying injustice.
And then what I also find interesting, it's from one of the experts that you spoke to, that this is not a story that's just about money. It's in fact about more than money. What do they mean by that?
This was our expert from the Third World Alliance. And he said, yeah, we don't want to just boil this down to a financial question, because then the temptation will be, look, I'll just splash some cash your way and you shut up about it. That's not the idea. That's not the spirit of what it is. We know in the case of agriculture, that there is benefit sharing happening, but it doesn't look like just a wad of cash. It will often look like, okay, here is some genetic material of our own. Here is this improvement that we can give you. Here is some knowledge that you might not know. Maybe it could be mobility for researchers and professors. Okay. So it doesn't have to be a cash transaction. It's more about the sentiment behind it. If we just boil it down to, I'm going to throw some cash in the air. Okay. And I'll keep going as I want. That's not the spirit. The idea should be that I'm going to act in a more equitable way. Now, whether that be a cash payment, whether that be an investment, whether that be a share of knowledge, I'll make it right.
You also do introduce some examples of how things could be done. What are some examples of how this benefit sharing can actually work?
Mm-hmm. So there are only really two examples I can give of benefit sharing, either in the plant sector or close to the plant sector, where something has worked. The most famous case, the kind of the industry standard, is the rooibos case. Okay, after 4 years of negotiation between the South African Rooibos Council, the Khoisan and the Sanitu tribes or ethnic groups, they managed to get a 1.5% levy on rooibos. That means that 1.5% of profits should come back to these communities, and there is some sort of a trust that that manages the money and makes sure it's spent well. Okay, 1.5% is not a lot. It's not a huge dint in the profits for manufacturers, okay, who are cultivating this on an industrial scale. But we already have some of the statistics, some of the feedback, okay, from what that is created. So in 2022, there was a payout of 12.2 million rand, which is around 620,000 euros, which was paid in equal amounts to those communities' respective trusts. So if you don't pay this levy, okay, if you don't get a permit to use indigenous genetic material, okay, then you can get fines, you can get in real trouble with the authorities. And it shows that even national initiatives can deliver results. Fortunately, for the flower sector, I have a slim picking examples of actual benefit sharing where you can sort of demonstrable trade.
And that brings me to the question, as a consumer, are there certain things that you can do to actually contribute to a more fair system? Is there also a consumer responsibility here?
So this sounds horrible, but nothing you do as a consumer is really going to solve the issue of Nagoya, okay? This is not like a problem of you as a client, as a shopper. It's more of a regulatory failure, okay?
No, it's also not like if I buy my roses fair trade that I contribute to a more fair system. It has sort of nothing to do with that.
As far as Nagoya goes, no. But there are still options that I would suggest to be more conscientious, okay? The first one you could do, if you were outraged by this, stop buying commercial flower varieties, okay? Don't give money to the major companies like Antura, Durman, Quartz, all those companies. Just don't buy them. Okay. You avoid that collateral damage. Okay. What else can we do? If we don't want to spend a ton on flowers, we don't want to stop buying flowers. Okay. You can invest local. So you can do the opposite. You can join what is called the slow flowers movement. Okay. There are some organizations. There's one called Deborah Prinzing in the US. There's Flowers from the Farm in the UK. There's Fleur Locale in France. Okay. And there are a few very small scale Dutch flower growers. Okay. The idea is that they grow what flowers are in season. Okay. That don't need to be kept warm or pumped with energy to keep them growing. Okay. That are grown locally from named farms. Okay. So you could get a British dahlia in August, okay, in Belgium here. You can get peonies in June, okay, tulips, you get them from a local bulb grower, maybe in April, okay. It works because you're cutting the emissions chain. You don't really have to worry quite as much about ethical considerations because you're using plants that are native to near you. Your flower garden will still look amazing, okay. Nagoya, you're not using genetic material that's been shipped from halfway across the world. It's a more conscientious approach. The final approach I can say is you could be your own bioscientist. Make your own cuttings. What biopiracy is meant to stop is you going and pinching material from other countries. And those plant breeders' rights are meant to stop you commercializing plants. There's nothing stopping you if you have a friend that's a nice plant, and you want to have that yourself. There's nothing stopping you taking your own cutting, okay, planting that cutting and cutting out some of that genetic chains, okay? You can, in your own way, live conscientiously. You don't give money to these companies that are exploiting the genetic material. It may be still that specific cutting is not local to you, but still you're kind of taking out the financial exploitation part. So yeah, you could opt out essentially from the IP system by cultivating between you and your friends and your family. You're allowed to do private non-commercial use even with these protected flower varieties.
Is that something you've started doing yourself?
Not yet, but I've been inspired. I have a terrace with very, very sad looking planters, which are completely empty. So I think after this interview, I'm going to go and put my gloves on and plant some local varieties, I think.
So all in all, it sounds like you have become more of a garden enthusiast by writing this story.
Oh dear, maybe so.
All right, well, that's where we'll leave it for today's episode. Thank you so much for joining me today, Dylan, and I'll be back soon for another episode. Thank you, Dylan.
Thank you.
You've listened to the podcast of Follow the Money. Our watchdog journalism is funded by our members. Subscribe and support European investigative journalism.